This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we hear about the no rationing of capitalism in the California drought. We also learn about the history of Kwame Nkrumah and his relevance today. But first, we have on Gloria LaRiva, a leader with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and we're going to discuss building the defense of the Bolivarian Revolution in the wake of the struggle at the Panama Summit and other U.S. attempts to threaten Venezuela. So Gloria, at the last count, more than 13 million signatures throughout Latin America and other countries have been collected to demand that Obama resend his executive order calling Venezuela an unusual national security threat to the U.S. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, it was really a grassroots campaign. Most of the signatures gathered inside of Venezuela in just a few days' time in anticipation of the Panama Summit of the Americas. And it was really a major defeat for the United States. 3 million signatures were collected in Cuba, and tens of thousands in the United States on the internet petition signers. But it was, all these petitions were delivered to Panama, and President Maduro of Venezuela spoke very strongly demanding that the U.S. cancel the executive order, which actually still remains. Even though Obama was forced to take back the claim verbally that Venezuela is not a threat due to major opposition in Latin America, the executive order still remains. The interesting thing is that on one side, supporting Venezuela's government was virtually every Latin American government declaring that Obama should rescind the order, opposing the order, and the U.S. on the other side had about 21 ex-leaders, ex-presidents from the right wing of Peru, Panama, Mexico, Chile, even reaching back to Spain to bring José María Aznar, an extreme right winger, and demanding that Venezuela free so-called political prisoners. Who are those men and women who are facing trial in Venezuela? Are the very coup plotters. Three people in particular, Leopoldo López, María Corina Machado, and Antonio Ledesma, who were actual coup plotters trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government of the Bolivarian Revolution in early February. And so the U.S. is behind this campaign to try to demonize the country and get together this really weak coalition of ex-leaders demanding freedom for these right-wing plotters.
And what was the response at the Summit of the Americas to the U.S.'s moves? In particular, what happened that led Obama to walk back on his rhetoric?
What forced Obama to take back verbally the claim that Venezuela is a national security threat to the U.S. was the collection of the signatures beforehand. It was a major, major response throughout the Latin American world, including protests, the petitions, statements brought by different Latin American leaders. But in the summit itself, the U.S. was really deflated in its plans to try to drum up a campaign against Venezuela in the Summit of the Americas. Cuba was very strong there as well, although many of the Cuban official delegates from the civil society were denied access to the Summit of the Americas, and instead extreme right-wingers, fascists like Felix Rodriguez, who actually brags about having assassinated the revolutionary Che Guevara, they were there. However, Cubans, Venezuelans, and progressive Panamanians had very strong protests against the presence of right-wingers that the U.S. was trying to bring in to try to create a campaign against Venezuela and Cuba. It was a real showdown between the progressive revolutionary left and Venezuela, Cuba, and other countries in Latin America against the U.S., which is still trying to act as if Latin America is its backyard. And the Obama administration, as Bush did in the 2005 Summit of the Americas in Mar del Plata, Argentina, failed miserably, which we, of course, were very glad about.
And we have about a minute left. Can you quickly talk about the connection between the threats on Venezuela and the resurgent right-wing movement in Brazil?
The United States government has a long-term and medium-term wider strategy against countries that have not towed the line of the United States, of course, against the Alba nations, but also against Argentina and Brazil. And that's why there is a mobilization of right-wing forces, right-wing parts of the population as well, who are trying to take back the government of Brazil against the Workers' Party, which for a number of years has engaged in many, many positive and social programs. So the right wing is trying to take back the power in Brazil, and the U.S. is undoubtedly behind that. In Argentina, the United States, U.S. courts, the U.S. government, and forces like the USAID, financing by CIA France, is trying to destabilize the Argentinian government for refusing to side with the United States against the progressive revolutionary governments of Latin America. There is a great deal to know about in Latin America, and you can read liberationnews.org for more information.
Thanks so much, Gloria. We'll talk to you soon. Next, we hear a talk that Karina Garcia gave this past weekend at the D.C. Conference on Socialism, entitled We Need a New System, where she analyzes the current California drought, now in its fourth year with seemingly no end in sight, and who the real culprits are of climate change.
Raise your hand if you've been following the California drought. Oh, it's a lot of people. It's kind of scary, right? All my family is basically from California. So I'm going to quickly summarize what's going on, and then we're going to talk about how can we go forward. So what's the problem? So the state of California is facing an extreme drought. It's been up to 4 years now, and it has, up to this point, no end in sight. Scientists say that the U.S. Southwest has a 50% chance of being struck with a mega drought that could potentially last longer than two decades. This would mean that tens of millions of people would be in severe crisis. The drought is caused by climate change above all, with less rainfall, but it's also led to massive draining of groundwater, which could lead to huge areas becoming permanent and basically uninhabitable deserts. So this is a huge problem because, well, not only is California the most populous state, it also produces half of the country's fresh fruits and vegetables. It produces 20% of dairy products and exports tens of billions of dollars in fresh produce to the rest of the world. So this is a crisis that has immense human, economic, and environmental implications for the state, the country, and in fact, the world. Just to give you an example of what this looks like, I wanted to show you quickly some GIFs. Already, some areas are completely without water in wells, in areas that have had these wells for generations, and some people are even relying on bottled water. So that's Lake Oroville in 2011, and then in 2014. So let's turn that off. It's pretty, you get the picture, it's pretty devastating. So the question is, what's causing this? So if you listen to our California Governor Jerry Brown, you'd think that the problem is that people are washing their dishes too long, or that they're taking too long of showers, that they're washing their cars too much, that they're watering their lawns too much. That may be true, but that's not the reason that we're in this mess that we're in. He's imposed restrictions primarily on cities and towns, which are expected to meet a 25% decrease in water use. And he's potentially fining individuals for their consumption. But as I said, that's not the core of the problem. He leaves out the oil companies. He leaves out the bottling industry. And above all, he leaves out the agribusiness giants who are using 80% of the state's water every year and are just draining, without any real regulation, the state's groundwater. They're just drilling deeper and deeper with really tremendous and irreversible damage to the environment. Thank you. So why do they need so much water? Here are a few statistics. It takes 700 gallons of water to produce a single gallon of milk. It takes 425 gallons of water to produce just 4 ounces of beef. And so for people like me who are wondering what exactly is 4 ounces of beef, 4 ounces of beef is a quarter pounder. So 400 gallons of water, like all of this room, right, for one hamburger. And it's not just meat that's the problem. Producing a single almond requires at least 1 gallon of water. It's a product that requires more than 2 or 3 times as much water as other fruits and vegetables like strawberries. And it's not a native plant or seed or whatever to California. So I'm not saying this to pick on any one like product or any one set of growers or anybody's dietary decisions. That's not my point. I'm saying this to bring up what millions of people are thinking. And that's that in a potentially catastrophic drought, there have to be better plants to grow, right? There has to be a better way to use our precious water, right, than 450 gallons for like a cheeseburger, right? There just has to be a better way to do things. There has to be better ways for us to get our calcium or get our protein. So why is this happening? So the whole world can see that climate change is happening. And this question is, it's really like climate change. We all can see it's happening. We all see that it can have potentially catastrophic consequences. We all know it's an emergency. But the leading governments and the most powerful nations in the planet haven't done anything substantial to stop it. They said that they need to limit the rise in global temperatures by 2 degrees to prevent irreversible and what they're calling runaway climate change. They said that if it got worse than that, the ice sheets would melt, sea levels would rise, and we could be looking at a global catastrophe that could have enormous displacement. They said that over the next 80 to 90 years, we could be looking at the complete submergence of entire cities like Boston, New York, London, Shanghai, Hong Kong, and potentially the entire state of California. Well, not only have they been unable to hold it to 2 degrees, but we could be looking at 4 degrees or 6 degrees rises in global temperatures. And that's not environmental or climate justice groups. That's the World Bank. That's the capitalists themselves. And all they've been able to do in all of this time is sign non-binding agreements that have zero impact on the corporations and the banks that are and the industries that are essentially doing whatever they want at the expense of all of us. So why isn't the capitalist government doing anything real? It's because the capitalist government isn't the real power. It serves the corporations and banks that are really the masters of the economy and society. The capitalist government can't even get less almonds to be grown in the middle of a drought. In fact, the moment anyone raises any environmental concern, the capitalists cynically take out billboards that say new regulations will just eliminate jobs. They say that restricting agricultural production will hurt farm workers. These are the same people who are paying them less than minimum wage for working long hours in the sun. These are the same people who, when they get sick, fire them. The same people who don't provide any health care for their workers, but now all of a sudden, they're worried about the farm workers. Some even have the nerve to say that the water crisis was caused by environmental regulations. But they get these talking points repeated and repeated by their political friends and in the corporate media, and so the politicians always pull back from anything that could infringe on private property. All these fundamental questions of how much oil to drill, or how many almonds to grow, or how many cows to feed, or where to build communities, how to organize transportation, those decisions are made by very small groups of people, almost all of them millionaires and billionaires, who get to make these decisions based on their private property rights. They see the industries they control as instruments to make them profit. And in fact, they're required to make profits by their investors and shareholders who invest purely based on what's going up and what's going down. So even if the wealthy politicians can't interfere with that economic dictatorship, what does that mean for working class people? It means that we're supposed to keep our heads down and we're not supposed to do anything at all. We're taught to accept that this is a normal way that society is organized, that the economy is too confusing for poor working class people, that no one, not workers, not community groups, not even elected representatives, should stand in the way of these brilliant captains of industry, these so-called job creators who are pursuing profit above everybody and anything else. We're taught that somehow it's normal for a small group of owners to tell billions of other people that this land belongs to me, that this water belongs to me, this oil belongs to me, this orchard belongs to me, that millions of animals belong to me, that technology and machinery belong to them. We're taught to accept that the whole planet really belongs to them, and that we're just living in it. But for most of human history, these would have been unacceptable ideas. That the resources of the land would belong to one or two people, that the decisions that impact the whole community would be made by one or two people for their enrichment, that the water and the minerals and the rivers and the lakes, that the water under the ground could be claimed by one or two people is just outrageous. As a matter of social necessity, these are the ideas that we must destroy, because if we don't, they're going to destroy us. So what's a socialist solution? Whenever a capitalist politician, even a mainstream Democrat, suggests limiting the rights of agribusiness and private industries to make decisions that affect all of us, they get called socialists. It's a way of shutting up opposition. But there's some truth to it. The leading capitalists can see, just like us, revolutionary socialists can see, that socialism is the real danger. They see that once people infringe on private property for the good of society, and it works, they might get other ideas. So let me describe briefly what those ideas are. The socialist vision is the opposite of how I described the capitalist order. It's based on the idea that the property and the means of production should be under the people's control. It's based on the idea that the decisions that have such a huge impact on our lives shouldn't be based on a few individuals. That these ideas should be accountable to democratic processes. That it's based on the idea that we can have a long-term, sustainable economic and environmental plan, and we do not have to just be dragged down the capitalist path of destruction. Instead of individuals who lord over agriculture or oil or water and land, we want a world without landlords. We want a world without billionaires and CEOs and private owners who monopolize all the scientific knowledge and machinery for their personal, narrow, selfish interests. A people's government seizing control of the economy would not only lead to more employment, in fact, an enormous effort to build new and improved infrastructure and create a sustainable economic plan would vastly improve employment. And we aren't just talking about capitalism with a few regulations, we're talking about socialism, which is based on the idea that the technology now exists to guarantee every person the right to housing, healthcare, education, and a job. That those things aren't far away, that those things can be a reality. This isn't a dream world that we're talking about. We're not talking about a world without any problems or without any contradictions, but these are solvable problems. This is a type of society that can and must be built. Right now, the capitalists decide who gets housing, healthcare, and education based on who can pay for it. They need to be swept aside, just like the kings and queens were swept aside centuries ago. For the people of that time, that might have seemed like an impossible task, that was just the way it was, but now they're gone and nobody misses them. We know that if the people seize the profits and operations of these industries, we would drastically reform and reorganize agriculture, transportation, energy resources. We could develop more efficient ways to use our water. And finally, after centuries of being alienated from the planet, we could finally plan our production in our society to ensure long-term sustainability. These are not unsolvable problems. Socialism is not an ideological viewpoint anymore. It's a necessity for the people and for the planet. So last thing, it's not just doom and gloom. We're not all dead yet. California's still there. I'm going next month. The most important thing we have to remember is that these problems can be solved. We can solve them if we're organized. We have to defeat the idea that we have no power. So when I say, who's got the power, I want you to say, we got the power. And when I say, what kind of power, I want you to say, people power. So who's got the power?
We got the power.
What kind of power?
People power.
Who's got the power?
We got the power.
What kind of power?
People power.
That's right. Thank you.
April 27th will mark the 43rd anniversary of the death of Ghanaian leader and revolutionary hero Kwame Nkrumah. President Nkrumah, who in 1999 was voted the second most popular African leader by voters on the continent, made significant contributions, both materially and theoretically, to the causes of socialism, Pan-Africanism, and anti-colonial struggle. The victim, like Patrice Lumumba before him, of a Western-sponsored coup in 1966, Nkrumah would use his time in exile to write numerous books that influence revolutionaries to this day. Born on September 18th in 1909 in what was then the British Gold Coast colony, Nkrumah was born of the Nzima, one of the Akan peoples that inhabit the Gulf of Guinea and have a proud pre-colonial history. It was the Ashanti, for instance, one of the Akan peoples, that for over a century, through five separate wars, led resistance to British and European imperialism in the area. Originally trained as a teacher, Nkrumah moved to the United States to further his education in the 1930s and 40s. Already burning with anti-colonial spirit, including inspiration from the first president of Nigeria, Nnamdi Azikiwe, who was also a famed anti-colonial leader during this period, he immediately became caught up in the radical current sweeping America, particularly in Harlem. Nkrumah met and studied with a range of revolutionary figures, including C.L.R. James, who taught him the rudiments of underground organization. Nkrumah would return to London to continue his studies in the late 40s, but ended up studying liberation, not the law. He quickly became a key force in organizing the Fifth Pan-African Congress in 1945 in Manchester, England, and worked to set up a range of African anti-colonial organizations. Returning to the Gold Coast, Nkrumah, along with his Convention People's Party, led a campaign that they deemed positive action, which included demonstrations. Returning to the Gold Coast, Nkrumah led the campaign along with his Convention People's Party that they deemed positive action, which included demonstrations, strikes, and other activities that forced the British to relinquish control over the Gold Coast colony, which Nkrumah and others were ultimately able to unite in the period between 1951 and 1957 into what became the independent nation of Ghana, the first African nation to emerge from colonialism to independence. Nkrumah, like contemporaries such as China's Mao Zedong, Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh, and Cuba's Fidel Castro, considered himself a scientific socialist and Marxist. He further developed an analysis of imperialism that offered an updated analysis from the basic framework developed by Lenin. And Nkrumah did this in his book, Neocolonialism, The Final Stage of Imperialism. Practically, this meant that Nkrumah recognized independence for the former colonial nations meant the end of the imperialist system of exploitation and the establishment of a socialist form of existence on a continental-wide level, a united socialist Africa, if independence for African nations was to mean independence. Practically, this meant Nkrumah recognized independence. Practically, this meant that Nkrumah recognized independence for the former colonial nations meant the end of the imperialist system of exploitation and the establishment of a socialist form of existence on a continental-wide level, a united socialist Africa, if independence was to mean anything at all for the former African nations, and more broadly, for former colonial nations around the world. His stewardship of Ghana involved attempts to industrialize the country and break free from the former colonial trade networks. It included aggressive attempts to build Pan-African unity, which, as Nkrumah noted over and over again, was the precondition to truly breaking up the neocolonial status that he had noted imperialism resorted to as a tactic to contain newly independent nation-states from escaping the orbit of their former Western masters. In 1966, the CIA helped to sponsor a coup that brought critics of Nkrumah to power while he was out of the country visiting Vietnam and China. Nkrumah then based himself in Guinea, where he was made co-president by the leader of that nation's independent struggle and president, Sékou Touré, and where he released a stream of books and articles, as well as organizing political movements that aimed at further developing revolutionary theory and practice on the continent of Africa and with applications all around the world. In particular, his writings helped to establish a materialist understanding of pre-colonial African society and the relationship of these societies to a future socialist Africa, including his famous polemic on African socialism that targeted Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and played a key role in establishing the differences between African leaders who talked about independence and socialism and those who really were moving towards an independent and people-first future. Today, there is much to be said about Nkrumah's history and legacy. But what is most notable is that his life and struggles and writings all remind us of the necessity of looking beyond capitalist imperialism if we seek to be free from oppression and exploitation. On behalf of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, we say Kwame Nkrumah, presente.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. And again, tune in next week for more from the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artists. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.